TLDR is supported by LegalZoom. LegalZoom's online self-help services can help start your business with DBAs, LLCs, or incorporation, or help protect your family with a will or living trust, but they're not a law firm. For a special discount, go to LegalZoom.com and enter code TLDR at checkout.
The best way to protect yourself is just don't take scandalous selfies. Don't take nude photos of yourself.
This is Kashmir Hill. She's written about tech and privacy for Forbes since 2010. This week, stolen naked pictures of a large group of celebrities circulated on the internet. But Kashmir's already lived through some version of this story a bunch of times. In 2013, it was Demi Lovato. In 2012, it was Olivia Munn and Prince Harry. In 2011, it was Anthony Weiner and Scarlett Johansson. And this extends back at least to Paris Hilton a decade ago. But this latest leak made her realize that her impulse to blame the person in the photo was wrong. Before, it seemed simple. If you don't want naked pictures of yourself on the internet, don't take naked pictures of yourself.
There are many articles where I've said that. This is the hard thing about being a writer, that your positions are captured. But I just don't think it's good advice to give anymore.
According to the Pew Internet Research Project, 9% of people have sent nude photos and 20% have received them. That's up from 6% and 15% respectively in 2012. And I'm sure that that number is much higher than people are self-reporting.
I think it's just part of relationships now, along with kissing and making out and circling the bases. I think we, send dirty photos to each other. It's just kind of part of digital courtship.
Kashmir says the same thing probably happened when Polaroids were invented. Technology gave people the ability to do this thing, so they did more of it. Plus, every time a celebrity's photos get sent around, it's actually an advertisement for sexting. Stories about celebrities who sext normalize the idea for a larger audience. I mean, how weird can taking pictures of yourself naked be if every actor under the sun's doing it?
So rather than telling people not to do this, knowing that they're not going to take that advice, kind of like preaching sex abstinence, I'd rather give people advice on how to protect themselves when they are kind of conducting their relationships this way.
Is there an equivalent of a condom for sending erotic photographs?
So much like sex itself, there's no surefire way to protect yourself against STDs, pregnancy, or heartbreak. Condoms break and birth control sometimes fails. And so I can't say that there's definitely a way to send a selfie and ensure that it never gets out in a way that harms you. But it's part of the reason Snapchat was so popular from the very beginning. And it's something that they kind of promoted in the use of the app was for sexting, because you're sending this photo to somebody, they get to look at it for 1 second to 10 seconds and it disappears. And then another thing you can do is encrypt files so that when they're in the cloud, somebody who got access to them wouldn't be able to look at them unless they have an additional password.
But even Snapchat, I would say it has a failure rate much greater than condoms.
I think Snapchat is actually not the best app to use, and there are other apps that have been created for safer sexting, including Glimpse, Wicker, Silent Circle. These are apps that have better security built in. But yeah, that's the problem too. When you create these images, you're sharing them with somebody, and you have to hope that their security practices are good as well, or that your relationship doesn't go sour and they don't decide to post the images. So there are a lot of things that have to change. One of them is this kind of societal attitude towards what you can do with those photos.
We were talking about sort of like technical prophylaxis, trying to figure out ways to technically keep yourself safe. But I mean, judging by your last answer, I'm wondering if it's a mistake to even focus on tech. I mean, is it really just about adopting a set of social mores that keep people from doing this because it's just reprehensible?
I think that should be part of it, that when these images are shared, that we treat them respectfully. I don't think we can limit it to social mores, but I do think the technical part has to be part of this. I think people have to practice better technological security, and then I think companies need to protect us. So one interesting suggestion I saw come from this whole debacle is, Google and Apple have private browsing windows.
Right.
So that you can look up certain things without it being captured in your browser history or leaving cookies on your computer. It would be wonderful if they had something similar for photos. So as they push us to back up more and more of our photos in the cloud, which is great because I don't want to lose photos from my recent trip to Hawaii, they should have an option to say, right now I want to take a private photo. This is a photo that I'm only sending to, you know, a significant other, and I don't want this one backed up.
Well, you know, one of the ways that this safe sex analogy begins to break down is with sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy, you know potentially what will limit your risk. Whereas in the case of computing, there are forces constantly at work trying to procure this information, either from you or from celebrities or from whomever. There are people constantly trying to figure out vulnerabilities to these services. And I'm wondering if this is something that we should think about legally.
So I actually profiled this DOJ and FBI unit in LA who focus on these cases that involve nude photos that are hacked or stolen and distributed. And this one FBI agent, I thought this was pretty profound, was that part of the problem is that we see these cases as a violation of privacy. But what he's thinking about when he's pursuing them is that taking someone's nude image they meant to share with one person and then stealing that is a kind of digital sexual assault. But if we thought about it like that, it might change the way that we create laws around this. And honestly, I think that there's been a societal change. 3 years ago, when this happened to Scarlett Johansson and other celebrities, there were far more people who posted links to the photos. This time, I haven't been seeing that. And when I do see people talking about this, they're talking about it less as this is a nude photo scandal and more as this is a crime against these women. And I'm really happy to see that shift in coverage.
Kashmir Hill writes the Not So Private Parts blog for Forbes. TLDR is produced and hosted by PJ Vogt and me, Alex Goldman. Our executive producer is Kat Rogers. Our engineer is Jen Munson. Our intern is Ethan Cheel. Our theme song is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like the show, please subscribe on iTunes. I can't emphasize that enough. If you'd like more TLDR, we're at tldr.onthemedia.org. We tweet at TLDR, and we are TLDR.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/outloud and use offer code OUTLOUD. A better web starts with your website.
This is The New Yorker Out Loud. I'm Sasha Weiss, literary editor of The New Yorker's website. It's a beautiful day here in New York City, and we just could not bear to be stuck in our windowless radio studio, so we're out for a walk with Adam Gopnik. Adam wrote a piece about why we walk in a recent issue, and we're going to walk and talk about just that as we take in some of the sights and sounds of the city. Okay, well, we're here with Adam Gopnik, and we're walking in the streets of Soho. Adam, how come you wanted to walk down here?
Well, this was for me the kind of prime site, Sasha, of walking in New York. I lived down in Soho from 1980 to 1995 when I left for Paris. And though for real Soho pioneers, those days were already the decadent era of Soho, for the non-pioneers, it still seemed like an authentic neighborhood. When I moved down here with my wife, Martha, nothing that you're seeing along here as we walk along Broome Street was in place. There was the one little cafe, the Cupping Room Cafe, but across the street, on the north side of Broome Street, there was truly not a single boutique or retail outlet of any kind. What there was the kitchen, the great old performance art space.
Mm-hmm.
And so the character of this neighborhood was still very much in transition. And it was a matchlessly wonderful place to walk, as I said in the piece. Well, one reason was that it felt like a beautiful industrial wilderness, still very much 19th century in character, that was interrupted by these little bursts and oases of chic.
And were you always making discoveries in those walks?
All of these neighborhoods, Soho, Tribeca, which was just coming together, the East Village, the Ukrainian Polish part of the East Village, the West Village right up the street here on Green, all of those places still had a very distinct character. Now, again, to the people who had known them in 1951 or in 1941, they had lost all their distinct character and they had become completely homogenized. So that perception of homogenization is built into the optic of New York. But they still did seem to have enough originality that you felt not that you were simply passing from one block exactly like the next, but you were actually experiencing this sequence of villages.
And tell us more about where we are. Tell us about some of these, about what we're seeing.
What we're standing on right now is the old illuminated sidewalks. You can't see it if you're listening, but what it is a iron frame with lots of little kind of glass lenses implanted in it. Now, these things are got these glass lenses in them exactly so that there can be enough light so you can see the materials in these vast basements that lie beneath it. Now, of course, the
so they're giving light to what's underneath.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
remember, think about it. There was no way when these buildings were built, there was no way of lighting them. It was before electric light. So the only way to light them was to use the light from the street, and it passes through the illuminated sidewalk down below. Why don't we walk up Mercer, too?
Mercer. You seem of the school of non-contemplative walkers. You seem a walker who engages very much with everything that you're encountering.
Well,
very kind of New York walker.
Well, I was in my walking days, which ended, as they always do when you have children, I was a contemplative, cynic, engaged walker. I almost always had my Walkman on. You know, the Walkman was invented in about 1980, 1981. But it meant that for the first time since the intrusion of the automobile into New York, into any city, you could shut yourself off from the sounds of the city and create your own oral space. And as I say, your own background music. I think one of the truths about music in cities is that they work best sort of at right angles, so that the music that you think of as being most New York isn't really what you want when you're walking around the city. You want something that comes from elsewhere, it seems to me. It's, you can't listen to Miles Davis when you're walking the streets of New York because it duplicates the experience instead of complementing it.
Well, you have a nice phrase in the piece. You say something about how walking, you know, kind of introduces serendipity into the grid-like structure of the city. And that's one of the special things about walking in New York.
One of the beautiful things about New York, of course, is that we are on this grid. But you're exactly right that one of the pleasures of walking in New York is that it randomizes the grid.
Mm-hmm.
When the moment you step into a taxi or a bus or the subway, you are going straight up and down or right across. You're going vertical or horizontal. Those are the two axes that dominate our life. And the moment you're on foot, as we are today, you can go wherever you like. And that feeling of randomizing your own existence is one that I think is incredibly rich and welcome. And in some odd way, you're drawn to the things that take you sideways, take you diagonally, that introduce a note of the random into your experience of the walk.
And what about the presence of other people? I mean, there are great walkers in history who you wrote about, who use walking as a form of meditation and a kind of inwardness, turning inward. But in the city, I mean, we just passed by someone who almost stepped on our toes with his cart that was full of some kind of canvas. How does that inform the walker in New York?
The neighborhood we're in, Soho, was one of the neighborhoods that Walt Whitman loved to walk in. Now, they didn't call it Soho back in those days. It was just Broadway. It was really what they thought of it as. And one of the things that's appealing in Whitman's accounts of walking in New York is, as I say in the piece, is that it's always about connection. It's not about cutting off. You know, one of the things that's true, I think, about the classic 19th century Parisian or European walker, the flaneur, is that the goal is to sort of be in a floating state where you are spiritually at least 2 feet off the ground, where you're able to observe, but you're not compelled to connect. You're able to observe all the types and varieties of urban life, but you don't have to actually plug yourself in to the socket where they manage. Whitman is all about plugging yourself in. The whole appeal of walking in New York for him is it enables you to connect with all of those types. It's the pleasure of what our friend Malcolm Gladwell calls weak ties, that the most important connections we make in life are, at least in urban settings, are our weak ties, not the people we know intimately who we could relationships we could reproduce in the suburbs or in the country, but all the thousands of people who we kind of sort of know, but don't have to know intimately in order to have a human connection with. And I think that one of the pleasures of walking New York is that unless you are truly a cloistered person, you will tie on to, you will Velcro to some weak tie in the course of a walk.
Okay, we need to take a quick break for our sponsors. We'll be right back.
This episode of The New Yorker Out Loud is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. Squarespace is simple and easy to use, with beautiful design and 24/7 support through live chat and email. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code OUTLOUD, one word. You'll get 10% off your first purchase, and you'll also show support for this podcast. Go to squarespace.com/outloud. Now back to Sasha Weiss and Adam Gopnik.
Just to our left here as we walk up is this famous, indeed notorious, NYU development, the Washington Square Village, it's called, which exemplifies everything that Jane Jacobs hated about the Corbusian intrusion into New York. If you look,
it's sealed off from the street.
Totally sealed off from the street, supposedly providing green space inside, but as a consequence, providing none of the quality, the variety of the urban street. And to add to that, I'm sure you know this, one of the things that happened, because this place was implanted in the middle of Greenwich Village with many supposedly local connections, is that it became a favorite mafia hideout. And if you read any of the books about the five families, great deal passes right here in Washington Square Village.
Well, that's another thing about New York. I mean, we're all kind of local celebrities, and our local celebrities are completely visible to us.
Yes.
I mean, you just see everybody.
You see everybody, and you have the possibility of a local thing. I saw Vincent the Chin Gigante. He wasn't a myth. He was walking along here.
Are there any other favorite characters from your walks, famous, infamous, or non-famous?
If we had walked the other direction, we would have, so speaking of mafioso, we would have found ourselves in Little Italy, where up until the day they hauled him off, you could find John Gotti holding court at the Ravenite Social Club. And he was out there, and you'd think it was one of those things, you'd think, you can't quite credit it, that they would be just sitting there looking like good fellas, but they did. That's another feature of New York I've always thought, is that people very much play the role that they're assigned to, and you're always sort of surprised by how in character people often are.
And do you think that has to do with the stage being so big and the capacity to fill the role? So
yeah, you know, when I, for 10 incredibly happy years, not quite 10. I wrote Talk of the Town back in the old days, when sort of the purpose of Talk of the Town was to chronicle the strange eccentrics and unseen corners of New York life. And you would find the oddest people, a slack rope walker who would put his rope across West 4th Street, a guy who taught nothing but Renaissance fresco techniques and who always walked around with the same kind of cap that Dante wears in Giotto, a woman who kept trapezes in her loft and kind of had a make-believe circus, one character after another who would present themselves in that way. And what was always odd about it was that you were sort of engaged in a collaboration with these folks in their own self-caricature. That was the way they presented themselves, mm-hmm. was as local figures, as characters. They presented themselves as characters, and they wanted to be caricatured, and that was part of their ambition. Deanne Arbus's photographs are filled with similar kinds of people. And one of the things I have noticed is when I got back from Europe in the early 2000s, and I wanted to write about New York again, is that those people had either vanished or been professionalized. They either simply weren't in place anymore because they depended on the same low rents that the artists and all other higher order creative people depended on, or else they had become professionalized. They had websites. They had PR people. They were selling themselves in a more finished and professional way. And so I think that's one more strata of New York experience that we have to mourn.
Well, maybe nowadays true eccentrics are all hermits of one kind or another, because that's the way to really distinguish yourself and make your work. Not to be outward, but to be hidden.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Sasha, that hermits and the idea of the hermit is essential to a particular kind of New York experience. But there is also the walking hermit in New York. And when I think of that type, I always think of Joseph Cornell. One of the most beautiful documents of the experience of New York pedestrianism are Cornell's journals, because Cornell would come from caring for his sick brother out on Utopia Parkway. It's still, for me, a name you get a shiver just saying in connection with Cornell. He would come from Utopia Parkway.
Which is
on
where?
The train in Queens.
Uh-huh.
And he would come in on the train to Grand Central and then walk everywhere. And his favorite haunt, being this hermetic figure who very, very few people knew about, much less knew that he was making these exquisitely poetic boxes of wishes and aspirations and nostalgia and memory, but Cornell would go up and down in a state of absolute bliss up and down those old Fourth Avenue used book and print stores, finding things and then take them back and go back to Queens and make, in the privacy of his basement, so to speak, make those beautiful boxes. So when I think of the exuberant, outward, gregarious, connecting, walk-to-connect pedestrian in New York, you think of Whitman. But when you think of the hermetic, inward, poetic, star-gathering walker in New York, I think we should always think of Cornell. I could be wrong, Sasha, but I'm almost sure that I'm right. This building, the one we're facing right now on the corner of, I am right because I look and see what it's called, Broadway and Wanamaker Place. This was the original Wanamaker's. This was the great emporium, the great department store of the turn of the 20th century.
And which is now, by the way, a Kmart.
Now is a Kmart with a loft in it as well. But if you look at it, you can recognize that this is the same building type as, say, B. Altman's up further on Fifth.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that fascinates me is that at any moment, one business type gets such a huge advantage in all its competitors and supplies a need so urgently that they develop insane amounts of surplus profit. Right now in our world, it's Amazon and Google, right? There's simply nothing Amazon and Google can't do. They can pay $1 billion for some startup, not because they're sure it will work, but because they don't want the competition, and who knows, right? And Amazon can do the same kinds of things. Well, in that period, Wanamaker's and Gimbel's, the great department stores, had that kind of cultural power. And anybody who does work, for instance, on the introduction of modernist art into America will find that the great department stores come up again and again sponsoring exhibitions, mm-hmm. because they had that kind of
cash.
They had that kind of cash on hand. So we don't think of this as Google 1900, but it very much is Google headquarters 1900. Hmm. And it's lost now. That's the other part, I think, about walking in New York that's different from all other kinds of any other city I know. And that is, the thrill is enormous, but the amnesia is immense.
Mm.
We have less marking, fewer plaques, fewer signs of not just the distant past of the city, but the immediate past of the city. You would not know that this was the great Wanamaker's, the temple of commerce, unless you happen to know it or you made the association between the lingering place name.
And why is that? Why don't we have these markets? I mean, in Paris, for example, I mean, it's an old, much older city,
right.
But there are a lot of plaques and a lot of municipal kind of declarations.
Shall we cross over here?
Sure.
The only time I have ever had a meal with a mayor was when I had breakfast with Mayor Bloomberg once, because I had written something highly critical of certain aspects of his policy, and he was having a breakfast for reporters, and I made that case to him. I said, you know, I've just come back from Paris, and it's also true in London, that everywhere you go, there's a plaque saying that the Marx Brothers slept here, Wanamaker's existed here, that you have a sense of living memory on the streets. And I said, really, we should do that, and wouldn't it be wonderful to have that in New York? And he said, with absolute, I think, honesty from his point of view, with what historical truthfulness, I don't know, that it would become such a spoiled system in New York, that New York politics is still so shaped by the conflict of ethnic groups, that it would become a question of how many have the Jews got, how many have the Hispanics got, and so on. It would be very hard to do it in any way that didn't reflect that. And he pointed out that what we do instead in New York is we have all of those designated street names that nobody uses, Dodge Hammarskjöld Place, or Duke Ellington Boulevard,
uh-huh.
or I think 86th Street is actually called Isaac Bashevis Singer Way or something like
so
that.
So we do it by oral midrash,
exactly.
instead of by municipal
planning board.
Plaques.
Yes, exactly. So we can do it that way, and that's the way that New York memory exists, is in street names that nobody ever actually uses, which is kind of New York if you think about it at all. Anyway, that was my one meeting with the mayor, and I was the one case I made to the mayor, and I was politely but brusquely brushed away.
I love that story. We're approaching the Strand, which is our final destination.
The last place. And this was a walk I took truly countless times in the 1980s. I would leave Broome Street where we started and walk, snake right through those still very varied landscapes, the NYU campus, the West Village. Usually duck into the East Village a bit for a bowl of borscht or the like, and almost always end up at what remains the last cathedral of the old secondhand book culture of New York, right here on 13th Street in Strand Books, much transformed over the last few years to become more of an up-to-date bookstore with readings and contemporary literature and so on, but still keep some sense of that deep repository of the vault that New York needs if it's not to become entirely, completely, and finally soulless.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Pleasure, Sasha.
Adam Gopnik's piece on walking is in last week's issue and online at newyorker.com. You can subscribe to The New Yorker Out Loud and other free New Yorker podcasts in the iTunes Store. If you're already a magazine subscriber, you have free access to the digital edition of The New Yorker. Download the app in the App Store or Google Play. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available at audible.com. The New Yorker Out Loud podcast is produced by Curtis Fox Productions and newyorker.com. I'm Sasha Weiss.
About 6 years ago, when my daughter Lucy was 18, she introduced me to a fashion blog by a girl in suburban Chicago named Tavi Gevinson. Tavi had started Style Rookie at age 11, and it made her kind of famous among the cool kids in New York and Los Angeles. She was embraced by the designers behind Rodarte and invited to New York fashion shows and treated like a celebrity. Although there were kids at school who rolled their eyes at her, and people in fashion and the media, even before she got out of high school, were wondering if she'd peaked too early. Well, Tavi Gevinson is an adult now, 18, and her remarkable ascent continues. Her blog has morphed into a full-fledged online magazine for teenage girls called Rookie, and it turns out Tavi Gevinson is also an actor, by which I don't mean had a part in a play last spring at Oak Park and River Forest High School. No, she is now starring in a play on Broadway called This Is Our Youth. It's set in the early 1980s, and it's about three kids growing up privileged and confused.
What you're like now has nothing to do with what you're gonna be like. Like, right now, you're all like this rich little pot-smoking burnout rebel, but 10 years from now, you're gonna be like a plastic surgeon reminiscing about how wild you used to be.
And Tavi Gevinson is here with me now. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So you are really amazingly good in this role.
Thank you.
So good. You really made my daughter adore and envy you all the more. The director of the play, Anna Shapiro, says that you in real life are nothing like the character you play in This Is Our Youth, Jessica Goldman. Is that true?
I definitely relate to Jessica in many ways. I think so much of the play is about coming out at the end of your teen years and you're not quite an adult yet and you're in this strange in-between. I stopped going to school about 2 weeks before everyone else in my grade because rehearsals started in May. And because I run this website Rookie, which is for teenage girls, like being a teenager and thinking about adolescence and writing about it and curating all this artwork about it has been so much of my identity. And so by the time the play started, I felt like maybe not, you know, by experience, but just through feelings in the same boat as Jessica, my character. You know, it's like I had a lot of ideas about who I had been and a lot of memories, but I had no concept of who I would become. And like, I think every day about how glad I am that I'm not in high school anymore.
Glad you're not in high school because you're freer to do what you want, or because the standard American high school scene was not your scene?
I really appreciated high school for what it was. I'm really glad I did it. I'm glad I never, like,
I'm
did
glad
homeschooling.
You did it too. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, there were times when it seemed like, oh, why can't I just work full time?
Right.
But it's like, I'm glad I did it, but I'm even happier that I'd no longer have to negotiate,
right?
Like, oh, I was in New York 24 hours ago, and now I'm in math class, and people are looking at me funny.
Right. Your character, Jessica, frets about how the adult version of her will be different than the 19-year-old version of her and talks to another of the characters about this. She imagines, she says, that it'll be like finding an old letter she wrote and not being able to connect with that person.
Yes.
or those thoughts. When, for instance, you look at your old blog style rookie, do you ever think like, whoa, that's a different person than I am now?
Yes, it's wild. It's like the first time you're able to do that, to look at an old picture of yourself and be like, that's me. That was my body. How weird.
Yeah.
I think I'm less scared of that part of life than Jessica is. I find it really freeing. I really like that I'll go through as many changes as I already have.
So you were, as a little kid in third grade and so on, into mm-hmm. musicals. And then you decided with Rookie, okay, no, it's fashion and style that really interests me. What accounted for that switch in sort of the focus of your sensibility?
When I started my blog, I was at the end of my sixth grade. And middle school is a really hard time, as we all know. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I had been rejected by that group. I wasn't cool enough for this group. Okay, well then, like, screw it. I'm going to repel everyone. So I became really interested in fashion, and especially in, like, really ugly, you know, conventionally ugly or unflattering designers and collections. And in seventh grade, like, for as much as it sometimes stung to be kind of bullied, it was also kind of like, yeah, bring it on. Like, I'm thickening my skin, which was probably really good practice for everything I do now.
So then, after this amazing success between ages 11 and 14, you decided to change course in your media enterprise?
Yeah. I mean, I started Rookie 3 years ago and basically stopped writing my blog at the same time. And Rookie is, you know, for teenage girls, so there's a bit of fashion.
Right,
but
right.
I think the strongest parts of the site are just, I hate to, it's such a magazine term, but like real life issues.
Yeah. For instance, how to think about community college, or in this
sure.
new issue about Michael Brown's killing in mm-hmm. in Ferguson.
Yeah.
Do you have models in terms of girl women's magazines for what you're trying to do?
I think I actually created Rookie because I didn't feel like there was anything like it. And I,
because Sassy had gone out of business?
Sassy went out of business, but I also felt like there were issues with Sassy that could be updated. Through blogging, I had met all these young writers and illustrators and photographers, and I felt like we just needed a home base and a community and a way then to lift up other young women who were trying to get their work out there.
And what did you feel wasn't being done by the existing media?
I don't know, just normal, like, talking like a person. You know, I never wanted to create some kind of, like, binary of, like, well, you have all these, like, mainstream girls magazines and we're, like, alternative.
Right.
I just wanted something that could just be nice and honest and normal and, you know, we wouldn't be relying on advertisers, so we could do whatever we want.
Right. So sometime in the last year, Rookie is going great guns, and you're in your senior year in high school. You decide to go for a role in this play that's going to be on Broadway. How did you know or think you were ready for that?
I don't really know why I think I can do anything that I do. Probably good parenting. I know that I'll be okay. Maybe,
yeah.
Like, even if I audition for this part and I'm rejected, my life will
How
stay
bad
the
is
same
that?
As it was.
Right.
Yeah.
At one point, you dance. You start dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Was that particularly nerve-wracking, or did that come easily, too? Because you're a good dancer, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
But maybe it's just me. But that seems like it would have been a hard thing to suddenly do and do proficiently almost alone on stage.
I don't know. You don't have a choice. It's not you. It's not personal.
Yeah.
If I look like a dummy dancing, I'm wearing a mask. So, like, it's fine. That's part of why I do it. It's like, this is a time where you don't have to be yourself and think about yourself as much as I do in my writing and everything.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to just go out there and feel somewhat fearless and know that I'm not doing it for myself. I'm doing it for Jessica and for Warren and for this beautiful, beautiful play that we get to bring to life.
Do you, as you look at magazine editors, actors, do you have models of, oh, that career, that person, that looks like something I'd like to follow in terms of my trajectory?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Who?
Susan Sontag. And there's a really wonderful essay about her by Wayne Kostenbaum in a book called My 1980s and Other Essays, where he spends a great deal of it just talking about how she refused to restrict herself. And for me, I mean, it's not so much about seeing, like, how many different things can I try and
right.
how many trades can I have. It's just, this is a thing I want to do, so I'm going to do it. I mean, it's taken a while for me to get out of the headspace of, like, oh, but I'm a writer and, like, I'm an introvert and I don't perform. But then I do performance. I love it. I love doing this play. I think when we have those identity crises, we're just limiting ourselves and it has nothing to do with the physical world. And so I just have to kind of start my day by listening to Kanye West and then I feel confident enough to do anything.
Well, Susan Sontag sat where you're sitting 11 years ago.
Really?
So, you know, I'll see you in 11 years when you've written a few books of world-changing essays and maybe a novel or two.
Maybe.
Thank you, Tavi Gevinson, very
Thank
much
you.
For being here. Tavi Gevinson is the editor-in-chief of Rookie Magazine, and she is starring in Kenneth Lonergan's play This Is Our Youth, which is on Broadway right now. You gon' touch the sky, baby girl, testify. Come up in the spot looking extra fly. For the day you die, yeah. You gon' touch the sky.
Intervening in biological processes to mass-produce food has always made some people who value nature above all nervous. But when scientists developed the capability to directly select genes in food species, the anti-GMO movement was born. GMO stands for genetically modified organisms. Activists like famous worldwide crusader Vandana Shiva have successfully kept a number of strains of genetically modified seeds off the market out of a sincere concern they might be dangerous. But the movement's tactics are often at odds with science and may hurt the very people in the developing world, Indian leader Vandana Shiva, who's trained as a physicist, not a biologist, claims she's trying to help. Mark Linus is a visiting fellow at Cornell University and author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. He was one of the founders of the anti-GMO movement in the United Kingdom and has fought alongside Vandana Shiva. But he now believes that the skeptical anti-GMO movement has become more anti-science than pro-nature and pro-health.
Skepticism is a reasonable place to start when you're assessing a new and potentially very powerful technology. So I don't have a problem with that. And, you know, I think my own activism in the past, you know, I was very strongly anti-GMO. I was one of the original anti-GMO activists here in the UK. You know, I personally was involved in destroying trials of GM crops, canola, sugar beet, maize. And I felt very strongly about it. But at that time, I wasn't well informed about the science, to put it mildly. And it was really only through writing scientific books about climate change, so a different topic, but I became more scientifically literate. And I realized actually that you had to look at facts which were produced by the scientific community, not sort of just what you were hearing, what I was hearing from the environmental campaigning groups who were all against GMOs already. But eventually I felt it was better to be honest, if you like, than sort of keep it as a dirty secret.
What do you make of people like Vandana Shiva, who's really attracted a huge constituency around the world and has a lot of power in determining how certain nations in the developing world deal with GMOs?
Well, I have a big problem with that, because essentially Vandana Shiva's case is that farmers in developing countries are better off being poor and better off using outdated seeds and outdated technologies. You know, she's somebody who gets paid $40,000 in business class travel to go and jet around the world to make speeches about how great it is to be a poverty-stricken Indian peasant. And so I have a big problem. I think it's important for people in developing countries, farmers in particular, subsistence farmers in particular, who've got their families to feed, to be allowed to access better crops, to be allowed to access agricultural innovations which can improve their livelihoods. The whole GMO debate, I think, is very skewed. People who are against it are against GMOs because they imagine it means, you know, big evil corporations, a model of industrial monoculture, which, you know, I'm not in favor of either. But it's a much, much broader field than that. And there's many ways in which genetic modification can actually be used to improve environmental outcomes.
Let's take some of the Shiva claims, some of which may have been embodied in your original position, and take them individually. GMO crops cause farmers' suicides in India and throughout the developing world because of the frustration over price or something else.
Yeah, I mean, this is a claim which it's a myth essentially, but it's one which is universally believed by people on the left, for far as I can tell. But, you know, the rate of suicide has declined in rural parts of India since the genetically modified cotton became available. And in fact, you'd expect that because it's been a huge saving for farmers not to have to spend money on pesticides. So it's a big benefit both for the environment, for biodiversity, and for farmers' health and livelihood. So this idea that it's been somehow a terrible disaster for farmers really is a myth, and it's one which needs to be addressed, I think, because it's actually a huge success story. Farmers have on average, it's brought, I think, several hundred dollars increase for most farmers' livelihoods.
The other claim is, and this Shiva and other activists make, is that GMO crops mess with nature, pollute the sort of DNA pool, spread pollen to other crops in the wild, change ecosystems. What do you say about that?
Well, all of these are sort of claims which don't apply uniquely to genetically modified crops, to apply to any crop. I mean, every crop spreads pollen. And if you're producing seeds, you need to ensure that you keep your flowering plants separate from those which could cross-pollinate. So this is completely normal stuff for farming. So these claims really don't have any basis or any special reason to target genetically modified crops in particular. So what it comes down to essentially is a sort of romantic appeal to the naturalistic fallacy, the idea that natural is always good. I think in industrialized countries, there's this kind of backlash where people feel that their ways of life and food supplies in particular are too artificial, and so everyone wants natural, the organic, and so on. And the genetically modified is seen as unnatural. But I mean, really, there's no scientific basis to this. It's a sort of emotional position.
Talking to Mark Linus, who's the author of The God Species: How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. Tell the story of golden rice and how that really symbolizes what GMOs might do in the developing world but are prevented from doing.
Golden rice is aimed at targeting vitamin A deficiency, which is a form of malnutrition which is estimated to kill between 1 and 2 million children per year who don't have enough vitamin A in their diets, primarily because they're eating white rice and very little else. And so the idea for golden rice was to put beta-carotene, which is the precursor of vitamin A, into staple food, into rice, which people are eating. It's called biofortification. It would actually supplement their diets and would prevent both the deaths and also the blindness, which are caused by vitamin A deficiency. The problem is that this has required genetic modification of rice, which has made it a target for campaigners. Greenpeace has campaigned against this for over a decade. Just this last year, there were campaigners who went and destroyed golden rice trials in the field in the Philippines. So you had this really quite extraordinary situation where a potentially life-saving intervention is being destroyed by activists who are ideologically opposed to it. And, you know, this has become one of the major currents, I think, in the GMO debate, is whether even humanitarian interventions should be allowed if they use genetic modification.
Have you come so far in your transformation of your position to have sympathy for Monsanto Corporation, which really is at the center of the demonization campaign, and, you know, has some issues to answer for here? Are you sympathetic? Did they get a bad rap?
I think that's a difficult question. I mean, I'm not in the business of helping out Monsanto. What I would like to see is an opening up of the tools of biotechnology so that they're not just in the hands of big corporations. I mean, to try to ban the entire technology because you're against a single company just is flat out illogical. It would be like trying to ban computers because you're against Microsoft or something.
To sort out the bad science from, you know, the reasonable argument here, is there any argument against GMOs or some change in the way GMOs are being marketed that you would endorse in the midst of all the confusing claims that are being made, that you would stick with as a criticism of GMOs right now?
There's nothing specific to genetically modified crops which should single them out for special treatment, even special regulatory treatment. I mean, all of the claims that are made about superweeds and resistance, all of those things apply to conventional agriculture of any sort. The science has moved on so significantly in the last few years that the term GMO, I think, is becoming increasingly meaningless because there's so many different ways now of modifying, editing the genome, moving genes around, deleting genes. When people want to know, is something GMO or not, it's not really something which scientists can give a clear answer to, because, of course, everything we eat, every domesticated crop, every domesticated animal is genetically modified from its wild relative, but not done necessarily in a laboratory, which is, you know, the way of doing it, which is now considered artificial and so horrible.
Mark Linus is visiting fellow at Cornell University, author of The God Species: How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Tamara. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Oh, gosh, the first album I bought with my own money was Maybe Patti Smith. You're talking about an LP, not a 45. Could be Patti Smith's Horses. I'm Tamara. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, live music in our studio from Alejandra Ribera. She's a Canadian singer-songwriter, and she'll perform songs from her new album La Boca here in the studio. Plus, we'll take a look back at a classic record from the summer of 1994. It created a frenzy for a hypnotic but hard-to-describe genre called trip-hop. We'll celebrate the 20th anniversary of the album Dummy by Portishead. But first, we're kicking off something special this week, and joining me to introduce it is Soundcheck's executive producer, Joel Meyer. Hey, Joel.
Hey, John.
I want to say, first of all, this was not my idea, what you're about to announce, but go ahead.
Okay, well, here's the deal. The staff and I think you're not really working hard enough.
Oh, well, that I can't argue.
Yeah,
with,
I mean, the two daily shows about music, the concert hosting, we feel like there's a little more work that we can squeeze out of you. So we've devised a series that we're going to run this week on the show called Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music. You're going to be hearing it here on the show, but also you'll be participating in it on soundcheck.org. The name is pretty self-explanatory. Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music. Now, about music is in parentheses. That's important. The question has to be about music. It can't be about horse racing. It can't be about soccer or scotch or anything like the things that you'd sort of rattle on about. It's got to be about music.
All right. So I know you, Joel. You've got a theme song for everything.
That's right. I have a theme song. This one's been particularly hard. So I'm just going to introduce – this is a draft. It's not the final theme song. So, Irene, let's hear what could be the theme to Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music. Ask me, ask me, ask me.
Hey, let me give them what they asking for. Hey. There are more questions than answers.
Now, it's the ending that I have a problem with there. It's that they can ask you something, but then, John, you won't necessarily say that you love them. I feel like that's the flaw in this theme. So now, there really are no real rules here. You can ask John Schaefer anything about music. That's why we called it that. But I want to sort of get you thinking about things you could ask John Schaefer if you're so inclined. So you could ask for advice. You might ask John a personal question about his personal music taste. Or you can try to stump John Schaefer.
All right.
Very smart guy about music, but I think there are a lot of smarty pants out there in the Soundcheck audience. So
right.
You can try to stump John Schaefer. So you can ask your question by posting it on soundcheck.org. Or you can leave your question on our listener line, 866-939-1612. We might play your question on the air, and John might answer it. So that number again, 866-939-1612.
I am easily stumpable.
Okay. Here's an example of the kinds of questions that people might ask. We went around the building here at WNYC and asked some of our colleagues for their questions. So here's an example of the advice kind of question.
Hi, I'm Beth Furtick, WNYC education reporter. John, my question for you is, who is the best pedal steel guitar player in the U.S. right now, and can you recommend a new recording by this person?
Well, this is always a matter of personal taste, but I think in this case, I have an answer that brooks no argument. Greg Leese is the finest pedal steel guitar player in Nashville and therefore anywhere in the United States. Beth asked for a recording. He's mostly a sideman. He's played with everybody from Bill Frisell to Johnny Cash to my favorite moment of his, which comes at the end of a song by John Doe, formerly of the band X. The song is called Grain of Salt, and it's just this amazing, emotive pedal steel guitar solo. It's brilliant.
go, Beth Fertig of the WNYC Newsroom. The other kind of question that we talked about, the personal taste question.
Hi, John. This is Anna Sale, host of Death, Sex, and Money at WNYC. My question for you is, what's your favorite Taylor Swift song?
John?
Yeah, not the biggest fan, but I am going to have to say that We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together. You know, the chorus is irresistible, and the part of the song that I should absolutely hate, where she's dissing the guy for listening to an indie record that's so much cooler than hers, I can't help it. It's just so cheeky. Never. The moment works. I'm really gonna miss you picking fights and me falling for it, screaming that I'm right. And you would hide away and find your peace of mind with some indie record that's much cooler than mine.
Anna Sale, there you have it, John Schaefer's favorite Taylor Swift song. Okay, a third question that you might ask John Schaefer, the stump John Schaefer question.
Hi, this is Elliot Forrest from WQXR. John, my question for you is, could you define the following musical periods in five words or less and give one example of a composer from each? This would really help me out. Baroque, classical, romantic, and contemporary.
Baroque first. Based on courtly dance forms. Oh, wait a minute. Based on courtly dance. That's five words already. This is going to be tougher than I thought.
All right. Okay.
Example, of course, Johann Sebastian Bach. Classical. Getting more emotional. Sturm und Drang. Can I use Sturm und Drang as like one term?
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
And a good example would be early Beethoven or, let's say, Mozart.
Okay.
Romantic. Looser harmonies, big emotional sweep. There's my five words. Late Beethoven's a good example, or I'll go for Liszt. And what was the fourth? Contemporary.
Contemporary.
All bets are off. I get one more word. Polystylistic. Many, many examples. I think I'll go with David Del Tredici, who throws everything but the kitchen sink into some of his pieces.
There you have it. You can get college credit through Ask John Schaefer Anything. Okay, now, those, I'm going to admit, John, you maybe knew about those before we walked into the studio today.
Yeah, but those were easy.
They were, okay. I'm going to throw one more at you, real stump John Schaefer question. This comes from Jeff Spurgeon, also a host at our classical sister station, WQXR.
John, there are two instruments I know of that you play by not touching them. One is the theremin, which is played by manipulating magnetic fields through hand motions, and the other is the symphony orchestra, which is played by manipulating people through hand motions. So, two questions. Is there any other instrument you play by not touching it? And what's the instrument you touch the most to play it?
Okay, so a real wild card question. So, what is another instrument that you play without touching it?
I would say the human voice.
Oh, that's a deep thought.
It's okay. An instrument.
Interesting. Okay. Now, maybe even more abstract. Which instrument do you play by touching it the most?
I'm going to say the human voice. It is, after all, a part of Hey, man, you're going to throw me these goofy questions. Okay. I'm going to give you the goofy answers.
Okay, all right. I thought that there was a not ready for radio answer coming with that particular. those are four good examples of questions that you can ask in this week's series, Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music. You can ask your question by posting it on soundcheck.org. You can leave your question on our listener line at 866-939-1612. Again, we might use your question on the air, and John might answer it, 866-939-1612. And we're going to be doing some other stuff online this week, so make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr, and we'll let you know what we're doing for Ask John Schaefer Anything About Music.
And I will answer, and occasionally I'll even answer correctly. Oh, I just thought of another instrument you don't touch, the MIDI data glove. You put the glove on your hand, and when you move it through the air, the computer, which you're not touching, makes music. I know, sorry, I'll stop now.
Welcome to Night Vale is a podcast about mysterious occurrences in a fictional town in the Southwest. Hooded figures appear in the dog park and a glowing cloud unexpectedly rains dead animals. It's been described as Lake Wobegon is seen through the eyes of David Lynch, and in June of 2013, its popularity suddenly exploded. The show was downloaded 150,000 times in 1 week and rose to the number one podcast on iTunes. Since then, the creators and narrator of the show have gone on live tours and continue to produce the show twice a month to huge online reception, and I'm very pleased to be able to welcome the creators of the show, Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, and its narrator, Cecil Baldwin, to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
And we invite our audience to join the conversation. If you have a question for the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Joseph and Jeffrey, what had you been doing before you came up with the idea of this show?
A number of things. For a job, I was selling green energy on the streets of New York City, which is about as pleasant a job as you can imagine.
You mean selling what?
Yeah, like you know how people elect their electric bill, they can choose different sources. I was sitting at a table telling people
you're
to choose.
You're the guy I used to pass by.
Yep. That was me. That was what I was doing. I also, you know, did a lot of projects before this one that did not go as far as this one.
That was I was working in fundraising over at right down the street from you over at Film Forum on Houston, and I had
so neither of you were into radio.
I grew up listening to a lot of radio. I grew up listening like a lot of teenagers. Tried to listen to Art Bell Coast to Coast when I could late at night. I also grew up in Mesquite, Texas, and there was a great community radio station called KEOM 88.5 that I grew up with that I really adored.
And is that where you got your influences?
I think I got my influences mostly from just the language that Joseph and I share when we co-write something. And I think just the idea of radio kind of comes out of our love of a single narrator.
And Joseph, when you are co-writing, do you sit down together and write it, or do you write separately and then compare notes and merge?
Generally, we take turns with episodes. They're not always released in that order, but generally we take turns with them. And then once one of us writes it, the other person does fairly extensive editing, so it ends up being kind of both of us.
And Cecil, how did you get involved in the show? Were you buying some clean energy at the time? Going to the Film Forum?
I wish. No, I was working with the New York Neo-Futurists, which is a theater company in the East Village. And Jeffrey was in the theater company at the time, and Joseph came to see our shows a lot. And I think Joseph had the idea for a podcast and asked if I wanted to record a pilot episode, and we did. And it just, the project kept going from there.
Did they give you directions on how to narrate these scripts?
You know, they really don't. They kind of trust it to me to kind of self-direct, which I appreciate. And it's actually very fun and surprising because I get the scripts and I get to kind of mine through the language and determine what to do with the language and then send it back to them. And then hopefully they're just as surprised with what I do with it.
Actors often talk about learning about their character through the course of a run of a show. Has your narration style changed as the show has progressed?
Oh, absolutely. When I go back and listen to the first 2 to 3 episodes, I was definitely playing the idea of a radio show host. And since then, it has become much more of a three-dimensional character.
You've become the character.
Yes, exactly.
Where is the show recorded and produced?
Well, it's recorded in Cecil's apartment. using a $60 USB microphone. Yes. We're very high tech. And then it's edited in my apartment using Audacity free editing software.
Do you make changes or in the storylines or narration based on audience feedback? Do you get a lot of audience feedback?
I would say rarely, rarely and never really directly per se, although, you know, we are certainly aware of the audience feedback, but most of I think our choices come from just kind of the where we feel like the story is, and some of that indirectly comes from audience feedback, some of it comes from what Cecil gives us as an actor, and others just come from where we want to go with the story.
Well, an odd form of audience feedback is that many fans have drawn elaborate illustrations of the show's characters. Then they send them to you? They know the address? Well, they know the address because you're asking for money. Do any of them coincide with how you've imagined these characters?
So personally, we get asked a lot about how we imagine these characters to look. And the answer for me, at least, is I don't. I just, to me, what a character looks like doesn't matter to that character. And so I personally do not have any picture at all of what these characters look like.
We do have a slideshow of fan art on our show page at WNYC.org. What about you, Jeff? Do any of these things coincide with what you've imagined?
No, I'm similar to Joseph. I kind of allow the voice of Cecil and the voice of the characters to kind of dictate the actions and who the characters are and what they're made of. And so whenever we get fan art, I'm always surprised at the creativity and what people are coming up with.
My guests are Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink, the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, and Cecil Baldwin, who is the show's narrator now, I guess we might say actor.
Yes.
Cecil, you've said that people with anxiety disorders will use the show to help calm themselves down.
It's very true. It has that late night radio feel to it. And I find that a lot of people who are anxious or have anxiety disorders do listen to the show, and it kind of helps calm and center them. Unfortunately, they then like to let me know that my voice puts them to sleep. Normally, I would be a little offended, but in this case, I think it's the highest compliment.
Well, it's only people with anxiety disorders, although LGBT fans say they listen to the show with their parents.
Yeah.
Why?
I think we get a lot of great feedback from people where we have a central character who is gay and whose partner is gay, and it is a very normal thing in town. I think we've talked to a lot of young kids too that feel like there's not a lot of representation in media that normalizes or doesn't exploit the idea of a gay character.
One of the most popular themes is Cecil's attraction to the scientist Carlos. When did you decide that would become a recurring theme?
Well, it's there from the very first episode, but when I wrote it in the first episode, it was kind of written as the joke of the perfect, you know, kind of hero, square-jawed teeth, you know, all that stuff. It was sort of a joke of the person that everyone is attracted to. And then it kind of developed out of just sort of Cecil, when he performed it, played it so straight and so sincere that I kind of wanted to write to that, and it gradually, that feedback loop grew until it became clear that it was a real story that should be treated as such.
Jeffrey, didn't you originally voice the character of Carlos?
I did. Very early on, we had just like six lines for Carlos in the show, and we just decided we were still kind of in that mindset of not knowing where Carlos was going to go as a character, and it seemed simple enough that I could just deliver lines articulately and cleanly into a recording, and we did that. And then later, as the character grew, we realized we needed to hire an actual actor, and we hired Dylan Marin, who's been tremendous.
We're going to listen to a clip from one of the earliest episodes. It sets the tone for much of what comes afterward.
Just a reminder to all the parents out there. Let's talk about safety when taking your children out to play in the scrublands and the sand wastes. You need to give them plenty of water. Make sure there's a shade tree in the area, and keep an eye on the helicopter colors. Are the unmarked helicopters circling the area black? Probably world government. Not a good area for play that day. Are they blue? That's the sheriff's secret police. They'll keep a good eye on your kids and hardly ever take one.
I'm amazed that people with anxiety disorders like the show. This is playing right to our paranoid fantasies.
Well, I think what a lot of them think, at least what I think, because I'm someone with a lot of anxiety, is the thing about Night Vale is it's terrifying and there's lots of things that can kill you, but people just get on with life. And since in real life, it's terrifying and there's lots of things that can kill you. That example of just being okay with it and going on with your life is actually very helpful.
On our show page, Chelsea from Las Vegas, Nevada asks, have any of the show's creators lived in a small desert town before? And why did you choose the desert as a backstop for the show, for the podcast, I guess we should say? As a Las Vegas resident, I particularly appreciate the beautiful desert locale.
Well, it's actually a drive to Las Vegas is, I think, what led me to choose that area, that kind of part of the world. I grew up in Southern California in kind of the suburbs of L.A., but I drove once by myself to and from Las Vegas, and I remember just being stunned by how beautiful the desert was. I'd always thought of it as desolate, and instead it was one of the more beautiful landscapes I'd ever seen, and it always kind of stuck with me. So years later, when I made Nightfall, it seemed the right landscape to put it in.
Brenna from Duluth, Minnesota writes, I have cerebral palsy, and Night Vale's unique take on people with disabilities, treating them as people first, is wonderful, especially when compared to the portrayal of characters in most other media.
I mean, I think
you have
we,
to be happy to hear that.
Absolutely. It makes us very happy to hear that. We, you know, we had a parent on our tour in March approach me that her son with who has autism doesn't really smile or laugh or talk to them much. And after Night Vale came out, he laughs at the show and he shares the stories with them. So I'm really happy that it has such a positive effect on people. And we do try and display characters in the world as we see them as realistic, real people.
Maddie Forrest from Los Angeles writes, have you had any dreams about episodes that you've written a voice, and have they inspired future episodes?
I can't think of a time I have specifically taken anything from a dream, Jeffrey.
I actually had a dream a few months ago. I think it was while we were on tour, so it was just the stress that I had a dream that we had completely like missed an entire 2 months of posting episodes, and then I got into a real panic. It was that classic like
oh,
showed
yes.
up to school and you forgot to take your
Let's
study.
I did not
test.
Make that come true.
When did you begin to see a surge in the podcast popularity, and have you thought about why then?
Yes, July 2013 and Tumblr. Mm-hmm. And it was the fan base on Tumblr that blew the show up. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that might have ignited that fire, but I think that it was definitely – we definitely know that it came from the Tumblr fan base.
Did it help bring more donations to the show?
Well, I mean, yeah, it completely changed the show. You know, not the show itself, but just in terms of it became a thing – from a thing that very few people listened to and that was a hobby, it became this thing that, you know, we tour with. And it became more of a job and a thing.
Yeah.
We are inviting your calls, by the way, in case you have any questions for the creators of Welcome to Night Vale. Jeffrey Fink and Jeffrey Craner, or to the voice of the show, Cecil Baldwin. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I mentioned the drawings. Cecil, what did you first think of the illustrations that are based on your character?
Well, it has definitely gone through a couple of incarnations where at first people kind of uniformly had this blonde-haired 1960s Mad Men-esque character. And then I think gradually more and more variations have happened from there where people, because we, you know, Joseph and Jeffrey don't describe what the character Cecil looks like, a lot of people realize, well, wait, there's not just one iteration of this character. And then since we've started touring and more people have become involved with the live performance, they're slowly beginning to incorporate who I am as a person into those ideas. And I think all of those are very valid and can exist at the same time.
Well, there's certain common themes in those more recent illustrations, a third eye, sleeve tattoos.
Yes, yes. None of which are mentioned in the actual podcast. That is all the fans collectively coming up with an idea and kind of running with it. Mm-hmm. And we are here to neither confirm nor deny any of that.
But then people see you live and they see, in your case, Cecil, you do have tattoos.
I do. I do have a couple of tattoos. But our live performances are definitely in the vein of radio theater. It's not more traditional theater where there's costumes and set pieces and things like that, and we're trying to magically transport you to the world of Night Vale and suspend your disbelief. It is definitely of the radio theater genre. So I think the live person and the character can coexist simultaneously.
What did you another theme in the show is the shadow government, which we heard a little bit about there before, which monitors people and sometimes abducts them. Were you being influenced by real life events?
I would say a lot of the paranoia and conspiracies in Night Vale, they come from two places. One is I've always just loved conspiracy theories. I don't believe them, but I find them fascinating. I find them as this kind of mythology of America. I also am a huge fan of Thomas Pynchon, and I really enjoy the way he uses these conspiracies that are absurdly complex and lead nowhere to kind of talk about the difficulties of understanding life.
Now, we're going to continue this conversation with Jeffrey Craner and Joseph Fink, the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, and its narrator Cecil Baldwin. We'll be talking about their podcast. After we come back from the news, we welcome your calls. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can tweet us at Leonard Lopate. That's our handle. So stay with us for more.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We are back with Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, the podcast that has how many people downloading these days?
I don't really know how many people. I mean, it's
you can
it's
keep
in
track
the,
of this.
It's thing. In the millions of downloads, but I don't know how many people.
And the man who makes it all possible, Cecil Baldwin, who does the voices.
I do a voice, one of the voices.
Yeah, but you're pretty much the voice of
the primary
show.
Narrator, yeah. Yes.
We have lots of people writing in, and I'm just going to go through some of these. But first, I want to take a call from a listener from Spring Valley. Avi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just had a quick question for the guys. If they were at all fans of or inspired by Stephen King's Dark Tower series, I get kind of a similar vibe, if they could speak to that.
Sure. I mean, I can speak to that. I've read the Dark Tower series a couple of times. I love that series. I think it's a lot of fun. I think the idea of building worlds and destroying worlds and the meta narrative of things, I think, is a lot of fun. I'm not going to suggest you learn all of your creative writing skills from those books, but I just think they're an absolute blast to read. I think there's a lot of fun qualities to them. So I definitely think there's probably some inspiration when I write that comes from those series.
Thank you for calling. You want to talk about some of the characters you've created?
Well, I mean, it's mostly a joint creation. You know, we sit around and Joseph and I get beers somewhere in Union Square on a train line near both of us, and we sit around and we talk about ideas. You know, I think one of the first characters I sort of created and fleshed out was when we did episode 19, The Sandstorm. I created the character of Kevin as the voice of the Desert Bluffs community that's sort of opposite of Night Vale, and also the intern Dana of the station, who sort of becomes the first intern that doesn't die in the line of duty working for Night Vale. So those are a couple of characters that started when I wrote that episode that I really grew to love.
You allude to a Latin American strongman as one of the donors of the show.
Oh, yeah, that was a while back. Jeffrey, you wrote that.
Oh, yes, I do remember this. Oh, my gosh. I'm trying to remember the line from
that.
That
was like episode three or four.
Very early on. Yeah, it was something along the lines
of... We've been paying attention.
Yeah, you guys did a great job. It was Cecil alludes to the fundraising efforts happening at Night Vale Community Radio, and they were struggling to reach their goal, and then suddenly they got a gift. And Cecil's like, I can't say from whom.
You used a real campaign slogan.
It was
slogan,
a real campaign slogan, and honestly, it's been 2 years since I wrote that episode. I cannot remember exactly which one it was.
Selena from Quebec asks, will we ever hear of Carlos's past, and if not, why?
I would say probably. You know, the way we write, it's just sort of the stories that seem interesting at the time and that build off what we've done. And so Jeffrey and I don't have like a 5-year plan for this show. And so I can't really say specifically, but I would say that definitely seems like an area I'd be interested in exploring at some point.
Definitely.
Tucker from Portland, Maine asks, where do the youth and young adults hang out in Night Vale? Any good spots for potential visitors?
Big Rico's Pizza.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, we get a lot of questions like that are like asking about the world outside of the scripts. And I my answer is generally, unless it's in the scripts, then whatever you think is correct. Like, it's not my place to tell you what you think happens in Night Vale other than what's in the scripts.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my blanket answer to questions like that.
Anne from London asks Jeffrey and Joseph, what does your day-to-day look like? Is WTNV currently your only project? And how much of your time does it take up?
Well, you recently rented a tractor, didn't you, Jeffrey? there's that.
That's part of, basic home care is one of my things that I do in my daily life. I mean, it is our full-time job now. We both left our jobs last year. I left in December of 2013, and you know, Cecil and Joseph and I, this is our full-time job. I mean, we all still work on other projects. You know, Cecil is still a working actor. He's still performing. He was just in Edinburgh Fringe Festival with the Neo Futurists. So, you know, we still take on other jobs. We're still writers Joseph and I are writers as our full-time job. So, and that is mostly Night Vale, but it's also other projects.
Did you have to speak in a Scots accent?
Oh, dear, no.
Max asks for you, Cecil, did you ever find yourself acting a little bit like your character or notice little things or quirks that are similar to him?
I think it's probably the inverse is true in that I try to find parts of myself that are like the character rather than, you know, I try to find anything that's true in my own life and then bring that to the character rather than the other way around.
We have another clip. This is from one of the early episodes, episode 3, titled Station Management. Let's take a listen.
Station management stays inside their office at all times, only communicating with us through sealed envelopes that are spat out from under the door like a sunflower shell through teeth. Then, in order to respond, you just kind of shout at the closed door and hope that management hears. Sometimes you can see movements through the frosted glass, large shapes shifting around, strange tendrils whipping through the air.
Well, I mean, you work at a radio station. That should be pretty familiar to you.
There's a surrealistic element to everyday events in this show. you do stress that, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it's an overlay of everyday life here. But, I mean, obviously, most of us do not have betentacled employers. Most of us, I would presume.
Betentacled?
Betentacled.
Well, yeah. You haven't seen management here at WMIC.
I just learned.
A book girl, 1970, book gal, 1977, from Massachusetts asks, huge fan of the podcast. I'm a librarian, and with all the wonderfully wicked things you do with your librarians in the show, are you aware of the huge librarian following that the podcast has?
You know, it's funny. Our current live touring show that we've been taking a lot of places is about the librarians of Night Vale and the horrible dangers that are involved with interacting with them. And I want to say at almost every single show, we have someone come up to us afterwards and being like, I'm a librarian. And they're always very excited about that, which I always love because I grew up, you know, spending a lot of time at the library.
Now, how have you adapted a podcast, which relies very much on people imagining things, to the live shows?
Well, like I was saying earlier, it really does kind of root itself in the radio theater tradition, where it's, you know, we have actors on stage in front of a microphone with scripts in hand. So it's somewhere in between theater and stand-up and kind of live reading. So it allows people to kind of picture the world in their mind, which is very similar to the podcast, and yet also incorporates the amazing actors that we have on tour with us.
And you've toured Europe as well? I understand you have a large following.
We're about to tour Europe next
But you get a lot of feedback from Europe?
Yeah, Definitely. And in the UK and in the Scandinavian countries, too, we have a huge following in Helsinki and Oslo, and it's been great.
And I understand there's also a book that's coming out.
Yes, we're in the process of working on that now. We're running through edits with our editor right now at Harper Perennial, and we have a...
Anything else? Dolls? caps? Shirts?
Yeah, we shirts, have a we do an online store through WelcomeToNightVale.com.
We have something like 30 items on there. We work with these artists that we really love and that we've worked with a lot, and they come up with just continually amazing things based on our words.
Yeah.
Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Talking with Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, the creators of Welcome to Night Vale, and Cecil Baldwin, who is the main voice of the show, the podcast. But I still think of it as a show.
Sure. Yeah.
It can definitely. Be both.
Yeah.
Thank you all for being on our show.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.